One of the important lessons that I learned when I was studying for ministry was to acknowledge when you're in over your head. Not that being in over your head is necessarily a bad thing. That's sometimes the place from which we begin to grow. But in over my head is where I find myself this morning, knowing that we would shortly be welcoming a family who were fleeing the war in Syria. And knowing that the family was Druze, it occurred to me that our congregation should know something about the Druze experience. And so that's something that would help to prepare us to be the gracious hosts that we hope to be. I knew from the beginning that I was getting in over my head and that I would have a limited amount of time to research the Druze faith tradition. It's not one of the traditions you normally study in seminary. I didn't want to present myself as an expert in this regard, and I certainly didn't want to be conveying information that wasn't accurate. So I reached out to the local Druze community in Halifax. I found it was indeed quite a small community. But I was able to contact two Druze families outside of Naras. Well, anyway, I rehearsed that, and I said, well, thankfully, I ended up meeting and talking with Wafa Elatrash, who's here with us this morning, and I was greatly relieved when she offered to attend this service. Her son, Armam, is here with us now, right? Very good. And we'll be contributing some music when we take our break. So the purpose of this sermon today isn't to educate you about the Druze religion. It's rather to help you understand the Druze experience and to make you more comfortable and better prepared to meet the family that we'll shortly be welcoming here to Nova Scotia. I hope that you'll sense from my presentation this morning that being Druze is more complicated, more nuanced, more subtle than can be conveyed in a statement of facts, in a series of questions and answers, or in a 20-minute sermon. I do fully expect and hope that I'll stir up your curiosity this morning, and I encourage you to do what I did and go to the internet and explore. There are many excellent websites, some not so excellent, many in languages that I don't understand, but there's lots of very good information on the Druze religion. What I don't want to do this morning is put our guests on the spot. I don't want them to feel like they need to answer questions from the congregation, because, as I say, those questions may require some nuance, and they can be complicated to respond to. So I'm going to keep an eye on Wafa, and if I make a mistake, I hope she'll raise her eyebrows or something. Let me know if I should backtrack. But for those reasons, I'd ask your understanding, and that I plan to forego the reflections portion of our service. Normally, after my sermon, there'd be a time for congregational reflection. But I think there's going to be so many questions that it's going to be irresistible to want to ask questions about the faith. And it really isn't something I don't think you can properly address in a question and answer period. I'm not sure this is going to come across really well in the sermon, but Unitarian Universalists like things black and white, like things laid out, like to have an answer very clearly. And religion generally is not like that. Religion is much more so. Okay. So as I read about the faith tradition that we call Druze, I was struck by several parallels, and you'll hear them coming up, I think, in the sermon this morning. Parallels with Unitarian Universalism. The first is the nature of the name, Druze. The word Druze was not originally used by adherents of the faith to describe themselves. It was a word used by people outside the faith. And it was used with a certain amount of derision originally. One explanation for the source of the name is that it was derived from the name of an early preacher, who actually the faithful Druze consider to be a heretic. Unitarians had the same developmental stage in their religion. It originally was a word of derision in our faith. It was meant to belittle us as Christians who were rejecting the Christian Trinity. But like Druze, it was eventually adopted as a badge of honor, as it were. It's my understanding that those in the faith tradition now, referred to in Druze, call themselves Muwaddin. Is that correct? That word, interestingly and ironically, is most often translated as Unitarian or monotheist, honoring their belief that there is only one God and that all monotheistic religions point to the same God. Over time, the name Druze has become ubiquitous, and I'll use that term for the remainder of the sermon for simplicity. The religion had its beginnings in Cairo, in Egypt, or just outside of Cairo. But it didn't arise among people who were native Egyptians. And in the 10th century, many of them migrated to the isolated mountains of Lebanon and Syria and Israel, while others settled throughout the Middle East. The slide comes up there. If it gives you an idea of where the Druze settled and where even to this day the major Druze villages and communities are. And you can see they're kind of scattered, and I believe they're all around mountainous areas.
Yes.
It was a place where they could feel safe, where the land was available, and so that's been home for 1,000 years. So today they're primarily located in the mountainous regions of Syria and Lebanon and Israel. For reasons I'll go into later, to be Druze entails more than religious affiliation. It's a culture, it's an extended and very tight community. The Druze have a flag. And that flag helps to strengthen their sense of unity. And they also have a beautiful symbol of a star. The star, like the flag, features the colors of red, green, yellow, blue, and white. And one of the problems with the internet is when you find many conflicting sources. So I found many different explanations of what those colors stood for. So I decided better not to go into that. Well, it all began in about the year 1009. Al-Hakim bi Amrith Allah began attracting followers, and the Druze sect was born near Cairo, Egypt. The early years were marked by fighting with members of the Shia, a sect of Islam that were incensed with the supremacy of the Prophet Muhammad, leader of the Muslims, was being disputed. Al-Hakim was an interesting individual, and the history books say he disappeared around 1020. And there are, again, different explanations of what happened to him. One of which he may have been murdered, another of which that he just thought he despaired that the religion wasn't growing the way he thought it would and gave up. But he had an apostle, Hamza ibn Ali ibn Ahmad. And he subsequently gave the religion its form and its content, and he formed the various dogmas and creeds of the religion. Hamza was an Ismaili mystic and scholar. He came to Egypt in the year 1014. And he assembled a group of scholars and leaders from around the world to establish the Unitarian movements. So in 1017, Hamza officially revealed the Druze faith, because earlier they had done most of this in secret because it was dangerous. But in 1017, they went public and they began to preach the Unitarian doctrine. Hamza gained the support of the caliph, the powerful political leader at the time. And the leader, which is highly unusual, issued a decree promoting religious freedom. See, highly unusual in the Middle East. I have some excerpts from that declaration, which I thought were interesting. Remove ye the causes of fear and estrangement from yourselves. Do away with the corruption of delusion and conformity. Be ye certain that ye have been given free will and have been spared the trouble of disguising and concealing your true beliefs. You are urged to declare your belief openly. You are now safe from any hand which may bring harm unto you. So here was a preacher who won the support of a secular ruler. That ruler then proclaimed religious freedom. That may ring a bell with some Unitarians in the room here. If it doesn't, we're having an introduction to Unitarian 101 after the service. That declaration that I just read was written some 550 years before our own Unitarian religious ancestor, Francis David, convinced King John Sigismund of Hungary to proclaim religious freedom in that country, an event unique in Europe at the time. Here's an excerpt from what was referred to as the Edict of Torda. In every place the preacher shall preach and explain the gospel, each according to his understanding of it. And if the congregation like it, well. And if not, no one shall compel them, for their souls will not be satisfied. But they shall be permitted to keep a preacher whose preaching they approve. Therefore, none of the superintendents or others shall abuse the preachers. No one shall be reviled for his religion by anyone. Not only did the declaration won by Hamza predate Francis David's work by 5 centuries, but it also was much more inclusive, granting freedom to all manner of religious teaching, not just Christian teaching. The support of Hamza and his teachers was short-lived, however, and in 1021, the newly installed powers ordered the army to destroy the movement. And so began a long history of swings between recognition and power for the Druze, followed by relentless, brutal persecution. In 1043, just 26 years after its public founding, Baha al-Adin, the Druze leader at the time, declared that the religion was closed. No one could become Druze from that point on, except if they were born into a family where both mother and father were Druze. And that remains a fact to this day. When I read that, I thought, we have trouble attracting people to our church. This makes it, like, really difficult. Well, it was during the period of the Crusades, when the Crusaders were ruling Syria, that period about 1099 to 1291, that the Druze first emerged into the full light of history. Because of their fierce battles with the Crusaders, the Druze earned the respect of the Sunni Muslim caliphs and were granted important political power. But once the Druze fighters were no longer needed to fend off the Crusaders, the ruling Mamluk sultans of Egypt turned their attention to the schismatic Muslims and the Druze, and they were once again brutally persecuted. This persecution continued under the Ottoman Empire, leading to a succession of armed Druze rebellions. Those rebellions won them some level of autonomy in Lebanon and Syria. Then between 1840 and 1860 in Lebanon, the Druze were pitted in open warfare against the Maronite Christians. Some 10,000 Christians were killed in the resulting battles. The Druze have always played a far more important role in Syrian politics than its comparatively small population would suggest. With a community of a little over 100,000, the Druze of Syria's southwestern mountains consolidated a potent force in Syrian politics and played a leading role in the nationalist struggle against the French. The picture on the cover of the Order of Service is the Sultan Pasha Alatrash. You recognize the name. Laf Alatrash is with us today. And she proudly told me that she's a part of that large Druze clan. Under the military leadership of Sultan Alatrash, the Druze provided much of the military force behind the Syrian Revolution of 1925 to 1927. And in 1945, Amir Hassan Alatrash, the paramount political leader of the Jebel al-Druze, led the Druze military units in a successful revolt against the French, making Jebel al-Druze the first and the only region of Syria to liberate itself from French rule without British assistance. And so it has continued to this day, a long history of warfare and persecution. Today, the Druze are severely persecuted and threatened by the rise of fundamentalist Islam, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Daesh. The Druze are undoubtedly a resilient people. They are remarkably adaptable. They integrate well into whatever country and society they find themselves. There are, for example, very highly respected citizens in Israel. They serve in the Israeli military. A lot of Christians will not serve in the Israeli military. At the same time as other Druze are very politically active, members of the Palestinian community living in the West Bank. The reasons behind this adaptability and resilience can be found in the nature of the religion. The Druze religion draws on many monotheistic traditions, from Plato and Aristotle to Judaism and Christianity to the ancient monotheism of Akhenaten. It's a religion steeped in a deep philosophical reflection. But the majority of the Druze population are not educated in the details of the religious faith. The Druze population is divided into two groups. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing these properly, but I'll do my best. The Ukal, the enlightened, and the Juhal, the non-initiated. You look puzzled. I hope I got that right. The enlightened portion of the population, which a small percentage, estimates on the website ranged from 15% to 30%. And it's only this group that have access to the holiest books of the faith and that participate in detailed regular religious services. The majority of Druze are not concerned with the esoteric details of their faith tradition. Instead, they have some practical understandings and moral codes that guide their behavior that are based on the more on their sacred texts. This allows them flexibility to adapt to a culture, whatever culture they find themselves in. So what are these political understandings that guide the majority of Druze? This I found fascinating. From the earliest days, the Druze faith has taught the absolute equality of men and women. An amazing fact in the 12th century in the Middle East. This extends to educational opportunities, to the rights of children within families. Women have been included in this enlightened group from the founding of the faith. A belief in reincarnation is one of the underlying bases of the Druze faith. They believe that the human soul never dies, but passes from a dying person into the body of a newly born baby. The soul may be reborn thousands of times before it is finally united with God. Each successive lifetime provides an opportunity to grow and to move toward that ultimate unity with God. The Druze believe that prayer and ritual are unnecessary when true knowledge of God's unity is gained. They consider prayer to be a constant state of being rather than something one does at specific times of the day. The fact that the religion is closed and no one can join it eliminates the possibility that they'd be seen as a threat trying to convert others to their faith. They follow seven moral precepts, or duties, that are considered the core of their faith. Seven moral precepts. Does that ring a bell? UU 101, 1 o'clock. I don't know what I'm talking about. Of course, we have our own seven principles. The Druze moral precepts are absolute truthfulness in speech. You must speak the truth. Protection and mutual aid to members of the faith. Very supportive community. renunciation of all other forms of worship or belief systems, repudiation of all forces of evil and despotism, confession of God's unity, acceptance of God's acts, and absolute submission and resignation to God's will in both secret and in public. Druze forbid divorce, forbid the use of alcohol or tobacco, or the eating of pork. So I'm going to end my introduction to the Druze faith here. I know I've raised more questions. I can tell Waffle wants to talk to me. So I hope that this brief introduction has been helpful. As your minister, I'm grateful for the opportunity to learn about this unique faith tradition, and I'm left wanting to know more. I'm more excited than ever to meet the family that we're sponsoring. Their religion, with its respect for other religious faiths, with its view on the equality of the sexes, with its simple guidelines and precepts, free of complicated rituals, put me at ease. I also see a faith tradition that has a long history of adapting to new cultures and new social structures. The divisions between the initiated and the uninitiated seem strange and would not be something I would choose for myself, but I can see how it allows for flexibility and adaptability and how it has protected the members of this faith community and contributed to their resilience. The Druze faith has proven its resilience in the face of the most brutal kinds of persecution. Today it faces other challenges as the world shrinks and as Druze leave their traditional communities to live in relative isolation and in foreign lands. I see a faith tradition that is adaptable, one that will find a way forward in these new circumstances. I didn't know this until I was preparing this sermon, but Amal Alamuddin, now Amal Clooney, is from a Druze family. Her father was Druze, and I understand her mother was Shia. Right. So if there ever was a sign that the Druze are resilient and adaptable, Amal may be that sign. I hope I've done justice to the topic this morning. I hope that Waffle will stay for coffee and conversation afterwards. I'm sure you're going to be surrounded by curious members of the congregation. And I look forward to feedback and discussion over coffee. Thank you.